Good morning, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and call the a subcommittee of the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. The reason I say subcommittee, as you can see, there's only two members here at this point. Now we have three, we have four, so we will open up the full Senate Judiciary Committee. Today we have multiple things we're going to be dealing with. The first one we're going to do is the informational hearing, which is informational meeting on tracking offenders through the criminal justice system. And we have Tricia Whitfield, I believe, that's going to be providing that information to us. So, Tricia, if you'll be so kind to come forward, that'd be great.
Crazy morning already.
Good morning, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. I'm Patricia Whitfield, Oregon State Police Criminal Justice Information Services Division Director. And I do have some information to provide you just for educational purposes on the criminal offender information system within the state of Oregon. The Oregon Computerized Criminal History System, also known as CCH, is the central records repository for criminal offender information and how agencies access that information and share that information for the administration of criminal justice. There's currently approximately 1.7 million records on file. The majority of those are criminal. Some of them are applicant records that are approved to be retained. A criminal history begins with an arrest. An arrest is, in our world, associated with fingerprints. When a person is arrested and subsequently fingerprinted, typically at a jail, those prints are sent to the repository for the purpose of determining whether there is a record on file already. So a name search is done and the fingerprints are checked against the 1.7 million fingerprints on file and determine that if there is no record already on file, we will issue and establish a state identification number, also referred to as a SID number. That can be somewhat comparable to a driver's license number. So a driver's license number and then a person's driving record. So that is the mechanism that we use to attach to an individual's criminal history. And while they might use a different name in every event, we're always going to go back to those fingerprints. So that's how the record is established. If we find that the person already has a set of prints on file and they have a record established, we're still going to maintain those prints and add that event to their criminal history, and therefore that's how the history is created and maintained of those events for that one particular person. A criminal history isn't complete until there is an action reported to us, typically from the courts, on what happened with that event, how was it disposed of, or if it went through the district attorney's office. So we also obtain the court disposition information to add to that criminal history to let the criminal justice users and law enforcement know, again, the complete history of that person, and then ultimately, if the person is put into custody or going into the Department of Corrections, that's the third part of what makes up a criminal history. Once we have established a record in Oregon, we are a national fingerprint file participant, and you might have heard of III and NCIC. Those are federal databases, information repositories, if you will, that index at the national level what kind of events are associated with that person within the state. So we would send a first set of fingerprints to the FBI. They would index that person, and then subsequent arrests and fingerprints don't get sent to the FBI. There's just that one index. If there's activity in another state or interest on that person, then the FBI would refer back to the state that owns that record. A record is retained at the repository and can be removed in three instances. If the person goes through the court proceedings and a judge orders us to set aside an arrest or conviction, that's one way that a criminal history record is affected. If the person reaches age 99 and hasn't had any prior activity in the last 5 years of that record, then just for record keeping purposes, that file would be destroyed. And then the last way is if a person is unfortunately deceased and they are fingerprinted at the hands of the agency that's reporting that case or dealing with that case, then they would submit the fingerprints to us and we would just simply clear out the file. So that's the context in short manner of what a criminal history is and how a SID number is established.
Okay. Questions? So one thing, Tricia, if someone has been gone through the process of an expungement and they get the order to expunge the conviction and or the arrest, what impact, if any, does it have on the SID number?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, if there is just one event on their criminal history and that is the record that's being expunged or set aside, then the record is removed completely. If it is just one of, say, 10 events, then that particular event is removed, but the SID number remains the same.
Okay. Just want to put that on the record. Any other comments or questions? Tricia, thank you very much for the overview. Mm-hmm. We'll go ahead and close the informational hearing. And what we're going to be doing is on the agenda, because of some different needs that we have for the committee, as well as some of the witnesses, we're going to put SB 199 toward the bottom of the list. And what I'm going to do is go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 387.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 387 comes to us at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. The bill requires a person arrested for driving under the influence of intoxicants to submit to fingerprinting within 5 days of arrest. Failure to do so results in disqualification from diversion. The Dash 1 amendments before you instead place the onus on the court to require booking on DUI charges and thus fingerprinting. A person who is not booked and fingerprinted would be ineligible for diversion until they did so, but there would not be a permanent disqualification for failure to do so in a timely fashion. The original bill has a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact. However, there's no fiscal yet on the amendments.
All right, I'd like to ask Judge Jones and Gil Meyer to come forward. That's the two I have on my list. Is there anyone else who will want to give testimony today on Senate Bill 387? And I understand there are amendments that we will be discussing as well.
Just the ones. Are there?
That's my understanding.
Okay.
All right. Good morning, Senator Przanski, other members of the committee. I'm Edward Jones. I'm a circuit court judge in I'm a circuit court judge in Multnomah County. And I've been doing that for 15 years, and I ran a public defender office for 15 years before that, and I was a criminal defense lawyer for 9 years before that, so I've been doing DUI litigation for 40 years. And one of the most frustrating aspects of it is that we've never been able to look at treatment and recidivism in any meaningful way. And of course, recidivism is just a polite word for new victims. But when we look at, does treatment work? How do you know? And there is no way except a very painful and slow person-by-person digging through records. The idea behind this bill is to get every DUI offender booked. And I suspect you're as surprised as I was when you hear that not every DUI offender gets booked. The reality is if you get arrested, you blow, you get cited, and in many jurisdictions, you don't get taken to jail and you don't get booked. And then you go to court, and if you divert or if you get convicted and don't get a jail sentence, two possibilities, you don't get booked then. And so we have no record that we can then use downstream to determine whether treatment worked. The goal here is to get everybody booked, and the way we do that is we say to the judge, when you arraign them, you say, have you been booked? And when they come in to go into diversion, the judge says, have you been booked? Or when the judge is going to sentence, have you been booked? And if they haven't, it happens. Then they all have a number. Now, it turns out that the health authority has a new computer system. The measurement and outcomes tracking system, MOTS, and they can track SID numbers. It's one of the fields they have. And so if we can get people booked and get the SID numbers onto the orders to the treatment program so they can report the SID number to OHA,
Then, after a few years, we will have real data about whether treatment actually works or not. We all believe it does, but there's not a lot of evidence, and we'd also get to see which treatment programs, if any, are better than others. I mean, if it doesn't make any difference where you send them, that's good information. If it does make a difference, that's even better information. So this bill is really just a step in a process of developing data about treatment, which will allow us to shape how we process DUI offenders in a more satisfactory way, less recidivism. That's the goal. It may take 5 years to get this all up and get enough data, but, you know, there's no other way to get to it. So that's the plan. That's the bill. I'm very much in support of the amendments. They turned the bill from a bad bill about a good idea into a good bill about a good idea.
Thank you, Judge Jones. Gail?
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We do want to thank Judge Jones for stepping into the conversation. The first iteration of the bill we thought was pretty problematic, excluding someone who didn't get who didn't submit to fingerprinting within 5 days. Sometimes people end up in the hospital, or they're out of town, or they're out of state, and it would be designed, I think, to exclude a lot of people from diversion if that were to be the way to go. Cannot quarrel at all with anything Judge Jones was suggesting about the importance of being able to track the efficacies of treatment. The difference between the bill and the amendment is the bill refers to submit to fingerprinting. The amendment refers to booking. And in our world, the difference there is the electronic mugshot that ends up on mugshot.com or busted.com. So may I make an inquiry of Judge Jones? I just don't know the question. Could you get a SID number if you only submitted to fingerprinting?
I don't think you can.
Okay.
I don't know the answer. I don't need their pictures. That's for my purposes. Yeah. Their pictures don't serve much purpose.
Ms. Whitfield, who testified, is going to come back up and give us the answer, but I'm going to give my perspective on it as well.
Again, Patricia Whitfield, Oregon State Police. The SID number is established based on fingerprints. Regardless of what you want to call the event, whether it's a booking or submit to fingerprints, that's what causes the SID number. A photo might be included with that. We certainly get those in a booking situation. But the SID number is the fingerprints. That's what establishes it.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Senator Przanski, this same concern that Gail raises was one that Representative Greenlich raised to me when we discussed how to go about this. So there obviously is some concern out there about these pictures. I would not let the picture problem get in the way of doing the work that needs to be done here, but on the other hand, if there's some way of doing it without the pictures, I'm happy with that.
So I'll just tell you the chair's position on this is I'm not real comfortable saying that we're not going to require or allow for photographs to be taken. I know the courts I practice in, they are routinely required to have a new photograph done on every charge so you have a identification of the person who's actually going through the system besides the fingerprints. So that's going to be one that, I mean, I'm not sure, Gail, what you're seeking to do if you're trying to limit this, because I'm not comfortable limiting practices that the courts already have in place, at least one of the courts that I have a contract with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. What else? I mean, in the sense of testimony?
Other than that, the dash one is good.
Okay. All right. Any questions? All right. Thank you all very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony again on Senate Bill 387? Not seeing anyone coming forward. We'll close the public hearing on 387. And my understanding is we do not have the fiscal on this and stuff, or
we do not have the fiscal on the dash one amendments.
All right, so we cannot move the bill at this point. We'll just wait for those to catch up, and then we'll bring the bill back forward. So with that being closed, we'll go ahead and go into our next one, which is Senate Bill 385. Jeff?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 385 comes to us at the request of the Oregon Justices of the Peace Association, the Oregon Municipal Judges Association, and the Association of Oregon Counties. The bill adds justice and municipal courts to the definition of court facility in which firearms and other weapons are permitted absent certain circumstances. Senate Bill 385 expands the definition of prohibited pocket knives in court facilities and authorizes the court to set policies and procedures to regulate weapons in those facilities. We have Dash 1 amendments before us today that specify that in shared court facilities, the policies and procedures of the circuit court will trump those of the municipal and justice of the peace courts. There is no revenue impact, and again, we are waiting on the fiscal impact statement for the amendment.
All right. I'm looking just to see how many people we have. Well, I'm going to go ahead and call up the individuals that are proponents, and then we'll do opponents based on the numbers that we have. It looks like we can pretty well cover that. So let me start with Judge Karen Weisman and Mel Conrad, I believe. Mr. Conrad?
Yes, Senator. I was in favor of the no vote.
A no vote? Okay, you put down yes, so.
I scratched it off. Pardon me, I wasn't reading it.
All right. So then let's have Carl Myers and Scott Winkles please come up at the same time. We have room for three. Your Honor, I'm going to give deference to allow.
Carl.
Yeah. I was going to let you go first. But.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Chair Prozonsky, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carl Myers. I am a municipal court judge in the city of Kaiser. I also represent the Oregon Municipal Judges Association, the Oregon Justice of the Peace Association, before this body. In Kaiser, the city attorney and I have a little disagreement. I believe under my broad powers as a judge, I have the right to limit anything, any activity or any arms or weapons or whatever from entering my court because of my job as the gatekeeper, the safety person in the courtroom. My city attorney disagrees and believes that ORS 166 actually does not allow municipal courts and JP courts to have any kind of rules or regulations either permitting or excluding weapons from the courthouse. I believe I win that argument because I've got the black robe. He actually wins the argument because he's the one that's going to have to defend me if I am sued for violating somebody's Second Amendment rights. This bill is to clarify that circumstance. When the legislature passed what is now 166.360 at SEC, allowing state judges to make decisions as to what weapons would be allowed in a courtroom and which would be prohibited in a courtroom, the legislature did not specifically list municipal courts and justice of the peace courts. We have the same safety issues that the state courts do. In fact, ours are compounded because we have very little money to do the check-ins that you see at circuit courts with the electronic devices and so on to keep those weapons even at the front door. So allowing us to control our courtroom and to have orders to prohibit or to exclude certain weapons based on the circumstance in the individual municipal courtroom or Justice of the Peace courtroom would be a very good idea, and that's why we're asking for Senate Bill 385 to pass. Thank you.
Good morning, Senator, our Chair Prozonsky, and members of the committee. I'm the Justice of the Peace in the Clackamas County Justice Court. This bill would regulate the possession of weapons in a court facility if you include justice and municipal courts in that arena, and it would allow the judge to either permit or prohibit.
I'm not sure if we caught your name, if you're on.
Karen Brisbane.
Okay, thank you.
I believe you called me first, but if not, I apologize.
I wasn't listening at the very opening.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Your name on the record.
Yes, so I'm Karen Brisbane. Thank you. We are a standalone court facility. We're handling a high volume of all types of violations, small claims, evictions, and civil matters under $10,000. Emotions run high, and there are a lot of people in our buildings. And I'm just here to relate a specific incident that's been a recurring issue in our particular court facility or court building. We're now a public building. In February 2014, a citizen who had a violation in our court researched the permitted locations where he could carry a loaded firearm and came into our building with his loaded 9mm semi-automatic handgun concealed to pay his bill to the court in pennies. He let the clerk see it. It was a great concern to the clerk and the other people that were in the building at the time. The deputy contacted him, and then he related that he also had another loaded firearm in his car in the parking lot. That was in February 2014. He now has another citation in our court and has indicated that he will continue to come back. And he always comes in with his firearm. The security person asks him to take it back out to his car, which he does, but he has researched the law so he knows what he's allowed to do and not allowed to do, and it's a concern when there are so many people coming and going in the building to have someone with a loaded firearm. So we're asking that you allow us in our standalone facility to have the authority to either permit or prohibit firearms.
Thank you. Scott?
Chair Przyganski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm appearing in favor of this bill. Oregon's municipal courts, in some cases, operate very robust criminal courts. Springfield, Cottage Grove, Beaverton, Salem, Florence, these are places where people are being sentenced to jail. They're having hearing contentious traffic issues. There's DUIs, and there is a threat. I'm aware of one instance where a person took a court action in Oregon City amiss, and to illustrate the point, he attempted to contract an assault on the judge. I believe he wished to have both of the judge's elbows shattered. And so we do have a safety concern, and we have experienced threats. And having this authority doesn't mean that every city municipal court's going to use it. It simply gives them the option to decide if someone if they should have firearms in the building. Additionally, in the way most municipal courts operate, they're hearing typically criminal or violation matters, and so we have a high presence of police officers in a building. So should an incident occur, there are trained people, professional police officers there who would most likely be able to resolve that issue. With that, I'm eager for your questions.
All right, questions? Thank you very much. I don't think there are any. So our next two speakers will be Kevin Sterick and Mel Conrad.
For the record, my name is Kevin Starrett. I'm the director of the Oregon Firearms Federation, and I'm a little perplexed by this bill. This has already been litigated. Municipal courts totally have the authority to regulate guns in their courtroom, as the judge has the power to do that. Most municipal courts already do that. We have an LC opinion about this from several years ago. So I don't really understand why this is necessary. These judges have this power now with their contempt powers. The problem is not that they have the power to do this. The problem is that municipal courts and these justice courts typically meet in places that are used for many other purposes. For example, in Canby, the municipal court met in the city hall chambers. They've now moved that to the police station, where the police station has signs saying no firearms are allowed, which is not within their authority to do, and they've promised they're taking them down. But since the judges already have the authority to do this, and since by putting this into statute, I have to take issue with the gentleman who said it would only give them the option. In fact, guns are prohibited in court facilities. It isn't going to be an option. If we declare municipal courts and justice courts court facilities, then there's nothing in the bill that says they're only going to be treated that way on typically the one day a week when municipal court is in session. Now those become facilities that are off limits all the time, no matter what's going on in that room. So if I were to go to a city council meeting in a place where the court used that building, that is now a court facility. and now I'm not allowed in there. And the same thing would happen where we are now in Cambie, and this is true in other places, where the court facility, the municipal court, is within the building of the police station. Now, that would be off limits. But I looked around the state. Almost all of these courts meet in places that are used for many other things. In some cases, it looks like these justice courts may be in people's homes. But since the judges have the power to do this now, to extend it to every single use of that room doesn't seem to make any sense. I don't know if you may want to reinforce their ability to do it, but certainly if you do, it should be at the time when they are conducting their court.
Understand. Mr. Conrad? Mel?
Yes, Mel. Chair Przanski, my name is Mel Conrad. I'm here as a citizen and as a person that volunteers as a PCP for Polk County. I also am a member at large on the local Public Safety Coordinating Council for Polk County, and I chair the Citizens Advisory Traffic Commission for the City of Salem. In the past, I have also been a facilitator for volunteer training through the FCL, the Family Community Leadership Program out of Oregon State. In all of these situations, there are public facilities that are involved. Nighttime, meetings. So I have occasion to come and go at all times of the day and night, sometimes without the benefit of sheriff's protection because of the limitations that are now that now reside in Polk County. I'm 71 years old. I am self-sufficient. I was brought up and trained by a father that was in the military that taught me how to properly shoot, and I was taught how to engage in trap and skeet, and my late husband was a police officer. How I use firearms falls and always has fallen well within the scope of the law, and I have been able to protect myself in situations where no other protection would have been available. So if I'm encouraging you to vote no, if what it means is to close down the possibility of legally registered, permitted people to volunteer in the governance of our communities, to participate in this with a feeling of safety and self-sufficiency. I urge you to vote no on the Senate Bill 385. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, we did actually have this very issue settled in Clackamas County in court in 2009.
I was going to add, Kevin, if I could just follow up on that.
Yep.
You said there's an LC opinion. I'd like to, if you can tell me what the number is, we can get hold of it potentially if it's been released to the public. And then also the statutory authority or the court decision, because based on my understanding, I'm not familiar with
the those. There was a lawsuit in Damascus. An attorney filed against the Damascus Municipal Court because of their prohibition. And when it went to, I guess it was the circuit court, the position of the judge was that, yes, although municipal courts and justice courts are not listed as courts in the statute, the judge still has the complete power. His patent, and I have the LC opinion with me. I don't see a number on it. I can email it to you later.
If you'll send it to our staff, yeah. That way they can get it to everyone. Because
in any event, that's the position they took, is that the court absolutely had the power to do that. And as I said, most of them do it now.
The other part, just for clarification, it sounds like your understanding is that there was a circuit court apparently in Multnomah County.
Clackamas.
Or in Clackamas County that came and rendered a decision. Do you know if that actually went up on appeal, if we have an appellate?
It did not.
Okay.
So it was left at that. That
so it would be limited. I mean, the jurisdiction of that court would be limited to Clackamas County.
Okay. Presumably, yeah.
Yeah, if you could send us the LC
certainly.
Jeff, that would, or to the judiciary, that way everyone will be able to get it. And we'll
actually,
be able to...
I'll stop at your office afterwards. I can show you where to find it online.
Okay.
Okay.
Any other questions? Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick?
Just no disrespect, but I forgot your last name, but I remember your first name is Mel.
Conrad.
Conrad.
Ms. Conrad. I take it from your testimony that you would not object to clarifying the judge's authority to clear authority to ban all guns when they're conducting court in a facility. Is that your position?
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Burdick, it is my position that, as I understand and as Mr. Sterrett has said, that there's already judges do exercise control in their courtrooms. I'm just wanting you to realize that there are other portions of these facilities that are not courtrooms that are available to volunteers, and they shouldn't be off limits in those cases.
So, but you wouldn't object to it, because we had previous testimony that it was unclear to some city attorneys, and they would benefit from a statutory clarification that judges clearly could ban the guns from their courtrooms. And I'm taking it, since you already believe that's a law, you wouldn't object to a clarification.
I'm not quite sure how to answer your situation.
I'm just saying, if we chose to clarify what you said is already the law, I'm just asking whether you would object to that clarification.
Well, Chair Brzezinski and Senator Burdick, my interpretation of the law is not sufficient enough for me to answer that. I bow to a higher interpretation by the judges that have worked within this law and with the case law that has taken place, as Mr. Sterrett has referred to.
Thank you for the clarification. And Kevin, just to note, you did state, and I understand, I wrote this down too, time and place. If you have these facilities that are being multiple use for a courtroom as well as the city hall chamber, that your perspective and mine would be the same, is that it should be when they're being utilized as a court facility, not as another facility. And that's what I took away from your testimony.
Certainly, and I would have no objection to a clarification. I would be surprised that it's necessary, right, that the judges may not know what power they have, but if there was a clarification that...
We'll look at the LC that you're going to get, and then we'll try to do some more research. We're not moving the bill today. We're just taking testimony. So, all right, any other questions or comments? Thank you all very much. All right, our next group will be Manuel Martinez and Roger Beyer. Yes, sir. Manuel? Did you not want to testify on this one?
That one?
Did you want to testify on Senate Bill 385? And we're asking you to come forward. You have to come up here to talk.
I don't hear you very well.
That's why we're going to get you to come up here.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer here, representing the National Rifle Association of America. As drafted, Senate Bill 385, we think is probably unnecessary. I would agree with the testimony provided by Kevin Sterrett. I think that judges already have much of this ability without this bill. The concern, just as you heard, is that these facilities are public buildings now, and therefore they are subject to the public building restrictions for carrying firearms and weapons, but not, which don't apply to concealed weapons holders. But if you make these court facilities, it is 24/7, and therefore no firearms would be allowed in them at any time. I see there's a Dash 1 amendment that is meant to, I think, clarify part of it. I don't know if you are entertaining the Dash 1 amendment, but from my perspective, the Dash 1 amendment potentially makes the bill worse, in as it says that the justice court or the municipal court could only make decisions if they don't contradict with what the circuit court has done on the use of or allowing of weapons and firearms. So I think that would probably make the matter worse, not better, from my perspective, if I'm reading that correctly.
I think there'd also be an issue between, say, call it separation of powers or levels of courts.
It may be true from a legal perspective.
I just got to let them decide that.
So, Mr. Chair, you heard a couple of stories about people legally bringing weapons into public buildings now. I didn't hear any incidents of harm caused by that. Maybe there needs clarification if there was. I didn't hear that. And you know, we don't object to judges being able to restrict the area of the courtroom while they're in court. If that's what this bill did, we wouldn't be here objecting to it. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you. Manuel?
My name is Manuel Martinez. Reside in Kaiser, Oregon. American citizen. And I opposed Senate Bill 385. You know, better than anybody else, that firearms are not permitted in courts. Judge has that under control. So this bill is nothing more than another waste of public money and public time. Before here, I heard reason why. Well, I have more reason than that, which cannot be answered. Why is the reason of this bill? You are not ignorant. Because if you are ignorant, you weren't here. And if you are ignorant and here, you shouldn't be here. You know that has to be something behind this. And what is behind this is disarm the American citizens.
Mr. Matt.
One step close.
Mr. Martinez, the bill is dealing with whether or not weapons should be prohibited in a courtroom.
Well, I don't hear so very well, sir. You can't come here to me and tell me. If you want me to leave, I leave.
I need you to testify as to your position on the bill as it pertains to
I oppose this bill for the reasons, and I will ignore the reason for this bill.
The reason I
don't call me. Don't tell me. Go around. Tell me. If you are here, you're supposed to be an honest man. You tell me the reason behind this bill. Because I've been there before in every nation in the world who has tyranny.
Martinez,
have gun control, every single one.
Mr. Martinez, the bill
is I heard what you said. You want me to leave? I leave.
I didn't say anything about you leaving. I just need
you
to
testify. You want me to leave? Answer yes or no.
I need you to testify on the bill and the germane subject of the bill regarding...
I ask a question. You want me to leave?
No, I don't.
Well...
I just want you to stay.
I don't want to talk to you in the way you want it. You want to listen to me. I don't need to listen to you. I am a free man. So if you want to hear, you have to hear what I'm saying. And if you don't want to hear, you tell me and leave. I don't care. I don't run for office. I don't sell in books. I don't sell in a picture. I'm telling you what my heart has, my experience, what you're trying to do to this country. That's just the way the world purpose I'm here. I am in the name of the people who was assassinated.
All right, Mr.
In
Martinez,
nations where
Mr.
gun
Martinez,
control was.
Mr. Martinez.
You want to leave now? You
Mr.
want
Martinez,
me to leave?
I've heard that you are opposed
okay,
to the bill.
You want me to leave? Yes or no?
Is that all your testimony as to the bill?
You want me to leave? Yes or no? Simple, sir. Don't go around. Don't call me.
I want to know if you have anything else regarding the bill itself.
Okay. You want me to leave?
All right. Are there any questions for either of the witnesses?
No, I don't ask questions. My rights are not to ask no question here. I'm here defending my rights.
I have a question.
Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. Hey, Manny, could you read the rest of your testimony, please? I would like to know what's in the rest of it, if you could.
Be sure that you have that in my testimony there.
Manny?
I'll be back, sir.
Manny?
Senator, can you? Senator Thatcher.
You, okay, never mind. I guess I don't. I guess maybe he will submit, hopefully, the written testimony. We'll get a copy of it. Perhaps. Because I see it right there left at the table.
All right.
It's not mine.
Any questions for for Roger.
Thank you,
right.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I also have on here Dave Factor, if you'll come forward. That's the last one that I have listed. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 385?
Good morning, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. My name is David Factor. I'm staff counsel at the Oregon Judicial Department. We are neutral on the bill, though we were the proponents of the Dash 1 amendments. The purpose of the Dash 1 amendments is that some justice courts share court facilities with in-circuit court buildings, and so we wanted to make sure that there were no conflicting orders related to weapons in those circuit court facilities. And so the purpose of the Dash 1s is to say that in those buildings where there are circuit court orders related to weapons, that those circuit court orders consistent with the court's security plans stand in priority to any justice court orders related to weapons. We spoke with the proponents of the bill about that prior to the ask request for the amendment, and they were okay with that. They'd shared the draft of the bill with us before introduction, and we'd had that conversation.
Okay. Point of clarification, I guess, basically, if there is a shared court facility that has an existing circuit court and one of these other courts, a JP court or a municipal court, was holding their court within that facility, the Dash 1s would state that whatever has already been put in place by the circuit court as to prohibition or acceptance of weapons would be the controlling position of the court?
That was the intent, correct, Your Senator Pozanski.
All right. Senator Cruz first.
A couple questions. Are you talking about where they're using the same courtroom or the same building?
Senator, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Cruz, we're talking about circuit court facilities,
right,
that justice courts in some jurisdictions use the circuit court facilities to hold justice court.
I understand that. When you say facilities, are you talking about the actual same courtrooms? Or
the orders, excuse me, I'm sorry to interrupt. The circuit court orders related to weapons deal with the circuit court facility, not just the courtrooms themselves.
Okay, well, I guess my confusion is, for example, in Douglas County, where the courthouse includes everything, you have to go through security to get into where the actual court facilities are inside the building, and that's where the restriction is, which is appropriate. It's not in the rest of the building. So I'm just wondering if what you're talking about is if they're in the same building, then what? Do you see where I'm trying to get with this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, yes, I certainly do. I lived and worked in the Lane County Courthouse for many years, and we have the similar situation. There's sort of the public service building. The court facility is connected to that. The circuit court order related to weapons in the court facility only relates to the circuit court component of the building, not to the rest of the county's
offices.
Operations.
I guess that was my point. If it's in the same circuit court facility, then there shouldn't be a problem. It should still maintain. But it's in some other part of the building. Are we doing further restrictions? And I'm just trying to make sure I get this straight here. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I appreciate your concern, and that's not our intent. Our intent is only within the circuit court building itself,
okay,
where the circuit court operates, not in other parts of the connected building that might have other county offices.
Okay. Yeah. And I don't have a problem with that. I mean, that's status quo.
I appreciate that. So. And I saw the Dash 1s for the first time this morning. If there's a clarification to make that work better, happy to work with committee staff on making that happen.
All right. Senator Thatcher, I wasn't sure if you had a question or not.
I do, but I haven't formulated it quite yet. So I got to, I'll talk to you later.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thatcher, I'm happy to come by and talk to you about your question.
You're not on the hot seat yet.
Oh, I was trying to.
We're going to try to give Senator Thatcher more opportunity to get that thought. Okay, I think that's it. And if you'll check in with her later, that would be great.
I'm happy to.
All right. With that, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 385. And we are going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 86.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 86 comes to us from the Senate Interim Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness. The bill authorizes counties to establish firearms training facilities on a lot or parcel that is an exclusive farm zone, forest zone, or mixed farm and forest zone, provided the lot is not within city or urban growth boundaries. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
All right. We have, looks like, I'm going to do two groups of proponents, since we have four, and then we have two that oppose. So Kevin Sterrick, Mel Conrad, if y'all will come forward again, please.
For the record, again, Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. Senate Bill 86 is a very modest, fairly restrictive bill that seems to just allow training facilities to exist in a place where we have so few of them. And what we hear over and over again from people who are opposed to civilian gun ownership is that we're not trained, and yet there's very, very few places where training is available. I know at my gun club, we've been trying to purchase the property we've been on for 100 years. It's very difficult. We've looked for other locations. It is virtually impossible to find a location where sighting a firing range would be allowed. And, of course, in this case, it's not even just a range. It's a training facility. And some of the opponents of the bill have made comments like dodging bullets in our forests and how this lacks common sense, that all of a sudden people on farms are going to be in danger. Of course, right now people can shoot firearms on farms and in forests already. What this bill is doing is allowing the creation of very standard, very safe facilities. And I would tell you, this doesn't just affect, I mean, this is not just a matter of us knuckle-dragging hillbillies who are shooting at your llamas. Most of the firearms training that's done in this state by the police is done on private shooting ranges. There are about 8 to 12 police departments that train at my gun club, and it's very difficult for them to have facilities themselves. And, of course, gun clubs may have to change their relationships with police departments in the future if the laws change and there are further restrictions on gun ownership, then having police at your range might become counterproductive. So I think it's kind of silly at the same time to say that we're poorly trained and then create a situation where we can't ever be trained. So we're supportive of the bill.
All right, thank you. Mel?
Yes, Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee. My name is Mel Conrad, and I'm speaking to you now as a member of the Oregon Citizens Lobby. Basically, we are for this bill. It meets one of our basic principles, our core values, that we hold very dear. Specifically, the local control. It is our posture that governmental power and functions should be as close to the citizens as possible for maximum oversight, control, and responsiveness. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions, Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the language of the bill gives the authority to the county to approve the use. What about a church? Would a county have the authority to deny a church building a firearms facility?
Well, I think it would matter if the church was operating on a farm or forest land, which the churches I've been to typically have not.
In my district, there are a number that are. This is a kind of ongoing conversation in my district about whether or not land use permitting can, kind of land use restrictions can fall over churches that are on large rural properties. properties.
If I may, I'm not really sure. Are you asking me if this bill would allow a church to create a firearms training facility?
I guess what I'm asking is the...
Because I want to go to that church, obviously.
I guess the question is, would the county have the ability to work with the neighbors and others, or would that just be an outright permitted use?
It's a conditional.
I don't think it's permitted. I think that's the point of this bill, is that it's not permitted.
Okay.
Yeah, my understanding, and counsel, I think you need to give us some clarification, but my understanding, this is a conditional use, that there would be an application that would be made, which would mean there'd be the hearing and everyone would be able to have a participant through the county level, through their county commissioners, is the way I understand it.
That's correct. The language says they may do this. So it's
not an outright.
Correct. And my understanding from my county commissioners is that there are, that you cannot apply land use restrictions to a church.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I'm pretty sure that's not the case, because there's a small church in my town that wanted to build a youth facility, and there were plenty of restrictions that prevented them from doing it without making considerable concessions to the city.
Thanks.
We'll get some clarification,
okay,
because
thank you.
I don't know if you remember, Representative Snodgrass had a bill at one point that dealt with siting of churches in EFD lands, and I thought that was actually, again, another conditional type of use that just allowed for that to potentially occur. Now, we will have Mr. McCoy up here from 1,000 Friends will be able to probably give us some direction as to what is or isn't allowed outright versus conditional for EFU lands.
Thank you.
Any other questions for these two?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just to expand on some of the points you make, you want the local areas to decide whether to allow these gun ranges. Would you also favor local control over other gun ordinances, for example, keeping them out of schools or keeping them out of public buildings? This is for Ms. Conrad.
Chair Pozanski and Senator Burdick, I was prepared to respond specifically to the wording of the existing bill before us. Not necessarily all-encompassing, or I wasn't prepared to look at anything that is vague and all-encompassing. Specifically to this bill, I was encouraging a yes vote.
So you would like to see local control when it comes to gun ranges, but not, you're not commenting on local control in other areas?
No, I wasn't prepared to make a comment, a universal comment, taking this language and moving it everywhere. It was just specifically for training facilities, gun ranges on the farmlands, presumably of sizable acreage and so forth.
How about you, Mr. Sterrett? Do you favor local control in other areas of gun laws?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I think there's a considerable difference between a law that dictates what a person may do when they're traveling through a locality. Say I am in a town outside of my own and suddenly I find out that I am in illegal possession of a firearm, versus a zoning regulation, because I think it would be quite unusual for someone to accidentally build a firearms training facility while passing through. So I really do believe that the preemption statute makes sense to keep us from having a patchwork of different bills. Like, if it would be as though Newburgh had a speed limit of 5 but didn't post the sign anywhere. So I think that zoning regulations really make sense on a local basis, but laws regulating behavior that has to do with traveling through the state really should be done so it's uniform.
So are you saying if it was posted, for example, in schools and public buildings, that you would be okay with local control?
No, I didn't say that at all. I said that we have a preemption statute that was designed to have our firearms laws be uniform throughout the state, so that, for example, if I were to go to Kaiser and they decided that stainless steel firearms were illegal, I would now be in violation of the law because I was traveling through.
So, right. so, So to follow up one more time,
one more
Mr.
time.
Chair. So what
not
you're
be repetitive, please.
What you're really saying is that you would prefer that this bill impose a requirement statewide that any firing range can go on to any piece of farmland, because that would be preemptive.
No, that's not what I said at all, and that's not what this bill does, Senator.
Thank you very much. I think that concludes our questions, unless someone else on my left, y'all's right, has a question. Thank you very much. All right, so let's see. We have others who are going to be testifying. I have Kay Bridges and Maxine, I believe, Walker. If I'm reading the...
Chair Pregrancy and committee. I'm Kay Bridges. I live in Multnomah County, but most of my family was raised, and I lived a long time in Washington County, rural Washington County. And I'll go ahead and read the testimony that I submitted so that the others can hear and it be on the record. I strongly support this bill because it would allow the counties to decide on an each-by-each basis whether or not to approve a firearms training facility. And the bill clarifies the lots and parcels that may be approved by the county. Ultimately, the counties will decide what is best for their communities. Not long ago, we owned 36 acres up on Chehalem Mountain between Hillsborough and Newburgh. Horses were never bothered by the gunshots, but they were scared to death when they saw fireworks. So why would a training facility be alarming to some? I was married to a former Air Force armament specialist who prided himself in being able to take a weapon, a gun, and that the owner had been having difficulty with getting it to sight in. And he would take it apart over and over and over again until he got it on target. He was efficient at that. And he improved the accuracy of guns that people had been having trouble with for years. It's kind of like fine-tuning a motor for a gun owner. It's a hobby that they enjoy, and the training facilities would also facilitate that ability, and it would be in the rural areas. We've taken marksmanship out of the schools. I remember when it was a big deal for the kid to come with a pickup truck and the guns in the rack on the truck to get ready for marksmanship class. We've neglected our training to the point that people are afraid and scared of guns when they need not be. I don't like gunpowder, and the noise hurts my head, but I respect the gun, and I respect the right of people to own and defend themselves. Each county can make their decisions with this law. Where a facility should be placed. There are some that think that it's taking away that right, apparently, when I was reading the testimony online. But the bill simply places the decisions in the hands of the local people that are closest to the situation, and that's a good thing. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 86 so that the counties can make those decisions for their communities. And further, that we definitely need to training, because ignorance creates fear, and when we have a knowledge of the use and respect the guns in our community, we will have a much safer society, as previous people have testified here today, being able to defend. She is 71, I'm 78, and I travel a lot at night. And I travel alone a lot at night on the roads. I wish to have better training available to me and to others like me. And I appreciate that option. Thank you for the ability to testify today.
Thank you for coming in to testify. Is it Maxine?
I'm Maxine Walker. I live in Portland, Multnomah County, and I really have no prepared testimony. I am here just to indicate my preference for that I'm in favor of this bill.
Thank you for coming in and putting that on the record. Any questions for our witnesses? Thank you very much for coming forward. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we have Marianne Nash, I believe, and Steve McCoy. While they're coming up, is there anyone else who will want to give testimony today on Senate Bill 86? Okay, we'll get you on after this, since you weren't listed on the registry.
Not really far away. You can go first.
Okay. Yes, it does seem like we're far away. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I am Steve McCoy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I'm here to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 86. First of all, I wanted to mention that firearms training facilities are already allowed on forest lands and on mixed farm and forest. That's in the OARs. That site is in my my written testimony. So this is really about farmland. This is about placing them on agricultural lands. So I'm going to focus on farmland. So agriculture is the backbone of the economy in rural Oregon. It's the number two economic sector in the state. It is 15% of the state's economy. 1 in 8 jobs in the state is related to agriculture. The current buzzword that you hear when you talk about job creation is traded sector. It is traded sector. 40% of the crops that we grow here in Oregon are shipped overseas. 80% of them are shipped out of state. Also, agricultural sales have grown steadily, relatively steadily, over the last several years, even through the Great Recession. Farmland is obviously the feedstock to farming. There are already over 2 dozen permitted non-farm uses, non-farm uses that are allowed on farmlands as permitted uses, and another 2 dozen that are allowed as conditional uses. If we're going to, well, so all of these different uses that are non-farm uses on farmlands take up a large amount of our farmland base already. If we're going to protect the number two industry in the state, we don't need new non-farm uses. In fact, we need to pare back that list of non-farm uses. There is an existing process for things like this, for this sort of exceptional situation, and that's the exceptions process. It requires an alternatives analysis and justification of the use. So this makes sure that the use is necessary if we're going to be consuming our important farmland, and that it's going in the right place to maintain the agricultural economy. Another concern is Mr. Sterrett mentioned the preemption statutes that exist in state law right now. ORS 166-170, 166-171, and 166-176, when read together, contain strict preemption language prohibiting local governments from regulating, restricting, or prohibiting the discharge of firearms on a shooting range. There is a limitation to the preemption for ordinances enacted before November 2nd, 1995. However, the preemption exception specifically does not apply to shooting ranges. So local governments cannot regulate, restrict, or prohibit the discharge of firearms on a shooting range. So once you have a shooting range, what can be done there is wide open. Noise ordinances do not apply. Conflicts with nearby farm operations can occur, including frightening livestock. So I think that's kind of the nut of the issue here for us as an organization, is protecting agriculture and also making sure that there won't be conflicts in the farm zone. So we ask you to support jobs in Oregon by opposing this bill. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And Marianne?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash. I'm the Public Policy Counsel for the Oregon Farm Bureau, and we are also here today in opposition of this bill. As Steve mentioned, agriculture is really the backbone of our state and the backbone of our economy here in Oregon, and it's hard for our producers out there. The more conflicting uses that come into their area, the harder it is for them to make a living farming and ranching, and the more people that end up going out of business, the harder it is for those rural communities to stay intact and to continue to have all of the services that they need to function as a community. So for us, as Steve mentioned, this is really about making sure that no additional conflicting uses get into ag lands. It's already hard enough to make a living without increased risk of conflict and just making it harder to exist where you are, increased traffic on roads, increased people trespassing on your property, in and around your property, questioning your practices. And as Steve said, there's already plenty of areas where these facilities can be sited without looking to agricultural lands. So Oregon Farm Bureau is also here today in opposition of this bill and urges you to oppose it.
All right, thank you. Questions? Steve, I have a couple just following up on your testimony. Regarding the exception process, could you just kind of walk us through as to how that would actually, I'm assuming there's a petition or some type of request that's made to the city or to the county commissioners?
So, yes, Chair Przanski, what you would do is establish it. First of all, you'd want to establish a need and say, gosh, we need a firearms training facility in this area, whether it be for law enforcement or whether it be for personal carry, whatever. So you'd want to establish a need, and then you do an alternatives analysis. And the alternatives analysis says, well, gosh, where is the best place to put this facility? And then whatever comes out of that, that's where the facility would be located. And that's where the exception could be taken, I should say, to allow the facility to be located.
So just for my understanding, that process would be, again, filed at county level, going through their planning department?
Correct, yes.
And then from there, the county could go to the county commissioners, mm-hmm. and this would be a decision that could potentially be, let's say, appealed or contested beyond that into LUBA, et cetera?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
LUBA Court of Appeals, Supreme Court, yes.
All right. And then is your understanding, in reading the statutes in 166, 170 et al., that once a facility would be established, that's your position or understanding is that the preemption that the state currently has would prohibit the county from having any additional regulations on what actually occurs at that facility?
Correct. And an additional concern is that this bill would allow this as a conditional use. Normally a conditional use, the local government has some sort of authority over whether they allow the use. And then they can also place conditions on the use. For example, noise or time of day, those sorts of things. I don't know. It would require litigation to figure out, but my feeling is that those conditions would not apply given this preemption clause.
Okay. Well, we'll look into that. All right. Other questions, comments?
I'm also happy to answer Senator Gelser's question.
Sure.
Either online or offline, whichever.
Well, why don't we do this? I have two more people who said they want to testify, and I have two bills after that. So if it's
all
right.
Follow up offline.
If it's, okay. Great. That would be great. And if it's something we need to have brought before us, hopefully Senator Gelser will share that information with us.
Great.
Thanks. All right. I saw two individuals that raised their hands. If y'all two would please come forward. Since I don't have your names on the list, we'll need to get those just that, and then we'll take your testimony. Who would like to go first?
I guess I'm nominated.
All right.
Chairperson Przanski and members of the committee, Senators Cruz, Burdick, Gelser, and Thatcher. My name is Jillian Hurst, and my husband, Patrick Collier, and I own and live on a farm-zoned exclusive farm use in the Linn County side of Staten. We oppose Senate Bill 86 not because we oppose firearms training facilities. A responsible gun owner should definitely maintain a training schedule for as long as she or he owns a gun. And currently, Oregon has plenty of authorized indoor and outdoor training facilities. That said, we would prefer all outdoor firearms training facilities to be located at least 4 miles in radius from any type of residential area or environmentally sensitive area for safety and noise pollution purposes. But SB 86 doesn't address those concerns, nor did the 2013 bill, SB 713. We oppose SB 86 because it's an inadequately written bill and does not take into account the fiscal and administrative burdens placed upon Oregon counties to approve or enforce the denial of a conditional use permit for a firearms training facility on EFU land, nor does it take into account the damage and contamination to EFU land from that type of facility. For almost 5 years, our area has been blighted because our county cannot enforce its denial of a conditional use permit on Queener Ridge Hunting Club of Scio. In June 2010, Queener Ridge applied for a CUP on EFU land it recently purchased, land that had been a working family farm for decades. Queener Ridge's application was unanimously denied by the county because the applicant wanted to operate a firearms training facility. Surrounding neighbors who also live on EFU land were greatly concerned about safety, noise pollution, and the detrimental effect on their farming operations. And the county found that the proposed hunting preserve would significantly change and significantly increase the cost of accepted farm practices on surrounding farm uses. Unfortunately, the county's denial did not dissuade Queener Ridge, and ever since 2010, there has been almost daily constant gunfire on the EFU land where the CUP was denied. And released pheasants from Queener Ridge's property have damaged other farmers' crops. We know this because it's only 3 miles from our farm, and we drive through that area often to visit friends, gravely aware of the gunfire at Queener Ridge. One dear friend of ours, Gisela Cowger, lives adjacent to Queener Ridge, and she has lived on her EFU land for over 50 years, raising a family, being a local school teacher, and enjoying her grandchildren visiting. Gisela is unable to be here today, so I've brought her written testimony to submit to the committee, and she has authorized me to include in my testimony one of the more recent terrorizing experiences. On May 5th, 2013, Gisela's 11-year-old grandson went to the creek running through her property to go fishing, but soon after, he ran back to her house because he saw two men wearing orange hunting vests and firing their shotguns about 20 yards from him. Lastly, directly quoting from Gisela's letter to the committee, she says, "For the last 4.5 years, I have endured the noise of almost daily gunfire. Often, I'm sorry. She's an 80-year-old woman living there alone on the farm. Self-reliant, I apologize. Self-reliant, she doesn't own a gun. She loves her land, she loves gardening. And as she wrote, it has taken the joy out of working in my garden, and you can hear the gunfire even indoors. Lastly, I'm fortunate to be here." Oh, thank you. "Lastly, I'm fortunate to be here and to have been alerted to this unfortunate piece of legislation. There are EFU landowners, particularly hardworking farmers, who couldn't be here today or who may not be aware of this harmful bill. Their voices and all those impacted by SB 86 need to be heard on such a detrimental change to Oregon's land use law. Please vote against SB 86. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. And thank you for protecting the welfare." Thank you. "The welfare and well-being of Oregonians and our environment."
Thank you.
Thank you.
Penny, did you have something you were going to add?
Yes, I did, and I'll be brief.
And if it's your reading of your statement, we have that as record. I prefer not to have that read into the record.
That'll be fine. I just want to add that I'm Penny Okamoto. I'm the executive director of Ceasefire Oregon. Ceasefire Oregon opposes Senate Bill 86, and everything is pretty much in my testimony. I just want to make sure they point out that a 22 caliber bullet can travel 1 mile, a 30-06 can travel 3 miles, and 1 square mile is 640 acres is 1 square mile. Thank you very much for your time and this opportunity.
Penny, thank you very much. Any questions? Ladies, thank you very much for coming forward. We're going to go ahead and close the you did very well.
I apologize. Here. Thank you.
We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 86, and we're going to go ahead and open up our next hearing on Senate Bill 199.
Not
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 199 comes to this committee from the Office of the Governor. Oregon law authorizes the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision to release a prisoner earlier if certain criteria are met regarding the prisoner's health, capacity, or reformation. ORS 144.750 contains a list of victims' rights. Senate Bill 199 amends those statutes and establishes victims' rights with respect to certain types of release decisions by the board. It requires victims receive 30 days advance notification of board hearings, to be present for the hearings, to present written or oral testimony at the hearings, to review information the board will rely upon at those hearings, and to rebut that information. There is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, thank you. So I've got four individuals who want to testify. I've got 10.5 minutes before I lose at least two of my members. So Kim Larson, Elizabeth Craig, and Christy Wiggins. I cannot tell what the last part of that hyphenated name is, but if you'll please come forward.
How do we do a law about how hyphenated names?
Well, it's just, it kind of fades out.
My apologies for my.
Yores?
It's Winges Yanez.
Yanez. Yeah, sorry, just
my handwriting. Yes.
All right, ladies.
Sure.
We're off to the races.
Thank you. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Elizabeth Craig. I'm the administrator of the Government Efficiencies and Communications Office for the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm here to provide information related to Senate Bill 199. As you've heard, Senate Bill 199 requires the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision to notify victims, if requested, within 30 days prior to a hearing or administrative decision to reset or advance an inmate's release date. We understand the board already has a process in place for making these notifications. However, there's a small set of releases that are somewhat unique that this bill may impact, and those are the early medical releases. So for background, early medical release is a limited option for certain inmates with severe medical conditions, oftentimes those with terminal illnesses who are nearing their end of life. It allows eligible inmates who have been through a screening process to release prior to their projected release date. The only agency with the authority to make this release decision is the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. The Department of Corrections' responsibility in this process is to do a thorough process of information gathering that is submitted to the board in order to make that final decision. So our process starts when we get a request for early medical release consideration. That request could come from the inmate, him or herself. It could come from the inmate's family members. Most oftentimes, it actually comes from our medical staff. These are the individuals who know which inmates may meet the criteria. Once a request has been initiated, we then do a number of things. We verify that the petitioner's claim of the medical condition. We verify the eligibility of the inmate from a sentencing standpoint. So, for example, Measure 11 inmates are excluded. We then compile a comprehensive body of information about that individual's status while in our custody. We solicit input from the case judge and the DA, and then we develop a tentative medical plan for continued care if early release is granted. The director of the Department of Corrections makes the ultimate decision to move that to the board for a ruling on whether or not to release. Senate Bill 99 contains language that would require the board to send written notice to victims no less than 30 days before this type of decision. We have no issues with the notification process. It's the timeline that we have an issue with. There's some further testimony, but for the purposes of time, I'll end with that and answer any questions you have after Ms. Yanez.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, I am Christy Winges-Yanez. I'm the chair of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. I'm here to provide information about our process and answer any questions that you might have. As Ms. Craig has said, the board may consider reductions in prison terms when an inmate is suffering from a severe medical condition or is elderly and is permanently incapacitated and unable to move from place to place without the assistance of another. That's the way the statute and the rule are worded. And additional to those medical requirements, ballot measure 11 inmates and inmates who have no early release in their judgment are ineligible. And that is a vast majority of the inmates in the system. The board reviews such requests only after the Department of Corrections submits a report, as Liz detailed. It includes the director's recommendation, other information about the case. The board also reviews the crime, the criminal history of the individual, and input from the sentencing judge and district attorney, as well as victims if they've been contacted by DOC, as well as the release plan for the inmate, which is typically to a nursing home. That's typically where these releases are going. So due to both the medical and the sentencing eligibility restrictions, the board has only received a handful of these requests in the past 5 years, none since my time at the board began in December of 2012. So we are talking about a very limited application. The board has historically reviewed these cases by administrative file pass, which means we don't have a hearing. Our Oregon administrative rule provides if a hearing threatens the health and safety of the inmate or the board shall consider the reduction administratively. The inmate may not be medically able to attend and participate in a hearing, as these inmates are typically very close to the end of life. The inmate's prognosis also does provide a sense of urgency to the board. And in my review of historical cases, it appears that these have typically been voted within a day or two, and that is to get the inmate into the nursing care facility. I will say in the three most recent requests, the ones I was able to pull from the past 5 years, there were no victims that had requested board notification, so I don't have that historical data. And if you have any questions about our process, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, Kim.
Hi, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Kim Larson, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association as well as the Marion County DA's office to testify in support of Senate Bill 199. I'm the Director of Victim Assistance with the Marion County DA's office and have been advocating for victims of crime for more than 20 years. And I can tell you that before I read this bill, I would have thought that the rights that extend to victims in the parole board process that they register for would have extended to these hearings as well. And the problem is, I think victims also have that expectation also. So this bill fills a gap that most people didn't know even existed within victims' rights for the parole board. The circumstances addressed by this bill are ones that would be addressed, like they've discussed, by hearings or mostly by administrative decisions, and victims wouldn't be involved in that process even if they had registered to be notified. And one of the things that we know about victims and their choice to participate in the process is that when they don't have those opportunities to participate in a meaningful way and they would have chosen to do so, their voices are silenced. And because of that, this bill is really important. And for that reason also, that's why we support this bill as well. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
All right, thank you. Let me just ask for clarification. Understanding the issue that we have here is the 30 days, understanding that's the standard for a general type of release, understanding that we are talking about someone, let's say, could be a grave medical situation. Would ODA be willing to look at something that would be less than 30 days notice based on their ability to get some notice out based on the timing they have to make the decision?
Chair Przanski, we would be willing to work with giving notice of some kind to the victim and making sure that that happens.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, that was my concern, too, was the timing of it, and because we are talking end-of-life situations here. And so, if 30 days in most cases, the person would probably have passed before anything could happen. So.
Correct.
All right. Oh, yeah, he saw me at 8:15, just to let you know. All right. Thank
you
all, ladies.
Thank you.
Coming forward. Gail, I know you were listed here. Did you need to? Excellent. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 199. We'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 600, I believe.
That's correct, Chair Przanski. Senate Bill 600 comes to this committee from the Criminal Justice Commission. Oregon law requires the legislature to approve adoption of and modifications to the rules of the Criminal Justice Commission. This bill approves adoption and modification to the rules of the commission. The rule addresses changes that were made by Senate Bill 6, Senate Bill 124, and House Bill 3194 from the 2013 full legislative session, as well as a few other modifications. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
All right, Mike.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just a brief introduction. Senate Bill 600 codifies the rules that the commissioners have to vote on. So the legislature modifies statutes or creates new criminal statutes. It's the Criminal Justice Commission's responsibility to then rank those offenses.
My name's Mike Schmidt. I'm the director of the Criminal Justice Commission.
Thank you. I'd catch up with it at some point.
Yeah. So it's our responsibility to rank those bills. Frequently, more and more often, it seems that the legislature is actually directing the commission on what level to make these crimes, as was the case in most of these modifications. Just for the committee's purposes, most of these changes came from House Bill 3194, but also from House Bill 2334, Senate Bill 124, Senate Bill 6, and Senate Bill 141. They are all out of the 2013 session, and it's our responsibility to get them to you to approve those rules before the end of this session.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on Senate Bill 600? Not seeing anyone coming forward, we'll close the public hearing and open up a work session on Senate Bill 600.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 600 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 600 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
I just have to say that it bothers me just to rubber stamp rules. You know, it just feels like that. It just feels like that. So.
But we have some good people working on these, including
okay.
district attorneys.
I understand that. I understand that. It just feels like we're just kind of just rubber stamping.
I guess, Mr. Chair, the only suggestion I would make is because this does cover Senate Bill 6, which was one of the Senate President's priorities, that maybe he ought to carry it, but probably
we'll
not.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Any other discussions? Any objections to the motion? Not seeing any. So ordered. Chair will carry the bill. We'll see if we can get the good president to assist. Thank you, Mike. And we'll close the work session on 600. And I believe that takes care of everything. And if I'm not mistaken, on Monday we're here at 8:30. Can we just check just to make certain?
Yes.
8:30 Monday morning. Thank you. Everyone have a good Friday and weekend. We're adjourned.